Support for Left, Right, and Center comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/LRC. That's odoo.com/LRC. Odoo, modern management made simple. Hey, everybody, welcome to Left, Right, and Center. I am David Green, and let's start the show this week with some strong words from President Biden. Now, I wish I could play you the sound of those words. I can't. He was actually talking to political donors behind closed doors, but we got the Pool Report. And in this meeting, the president had a very stern warning for Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He said that Israel was losing support around the world because of its, quote, indiscriminate bombing in Gaza. Now, the president did reaffirm U.S. support for Israel, but he told these donors about a conversation he said he had with Netanyahu. He said the Israeli leader brought up past U.S. behavior. You carpet bombed Germany. You dropped the atom bomb. A lot of civilians died. Biden said he told Netanyahu in response, yeah, that's why all these institutions were set up after World War II, to see to it that it didn't happen again. Don't make the same mistakes we made in 9/11. There's no reason why we had to be in a war in Afghanistan. So that's a conversation between President Biden and Benjamin Netanyahu that President Biden relayed to political donors as he was delivering a stern message to Israel, saying that the indiscriminate bombing in Gaza could lead to waning support around the world for Israel. I want to bring in our regular crew, Moa Lathy, Sarah Isger, a lot to talk about. And, you know, we are heading into the 2024 election year, as we all know. And, you know, foreign policy, we talk about it a lot. Open question as to how much voters actually think about it when they go to the polls. But I just think that the president's foreign policy does seem front and center as we think about Israel and Gaza and how much it's on the minds of people as we think about the war in Ukraine and all the congressional battles over whether to continue sending U.S. support to Ukraine. And I want to get to kind of foreign policy in general and this White House and the president as he seeks re-election. But let me start with this warning to Netanyahu from Biden, because this is a different tone than what we heard from President Biden. Very different, you know, in those days and weeks after the attack by Hamas on October 7th. Mo, what are you hearing from the president right now?
I'm hearing realism. I'm hearing him express sort of what I think a lot of people across the country feel. And we've talked about this on the show quite a bit over the past few weeks. It is possible to support Israel, to support its right to defend itself, to support its desire and need to eradicate Hamas, but not be happy with how they're doing it. And I think there are a lot of people across the country who feel that way. And I think he's right in a couple of ways. One, that Israel, we have seen an erosion of support for Israel since October 7th. In the immediate aftermath, the whole world was united in support of Israel and expressed outrage over the brutal terrorist attack that Hamas waged against Israeli citizens. But as Israel's response turned to the seemingly indiscriminate death of Palestinian civilians, a lot of people are appalled. And they are losing support. They're seeing traditionally strong Western allies say this publicly. What the president is saying privately, we're hearing strong Western allies say it publicly. And that's a problem for Israel. As someone that wants to see Israel succeed in destroying Hamas, it's a problem for them. Secondly, he's right. We have made mistakes in the past. We have made mistakes, and we have seen public opinion turn against the United States as a result. There's no need for Israel to follow down that path. It can learn from those mistakes. And while I'm no military expert, there has to be a better way to get rid of Hamas than what we are seeing with the death of so many Palestinian civilians, so many Palestinian children, which is just strengthening support in Palestine for Hamas, creating more future potential terrorists than it is solving the immediate problem.
I guess, and Sarah, I want to bring you right in, but one reaction I have to what you just said, Mo, is you could argue that that's a very reactionary policy. Like it was waiting for all of this to happen to now say, oh, this indiscriminate bombing is terrible. There are a lot of people who I think would say that the president waited this long to come out and say that this is bad policy. I guess I wonder, is that leadership? But
I think he's just becoming slightly more public in it. I mean, there was reporting in the immediate weeks after October 7th where the president was delivering this message to the Netanyahu government privately. Now, publicly, he was standing with Israel, but he was sending them pretty strong messages as soon as they began their response privately. At least that's what the reporting tells us, sending them pretty strong messages that they have to be careful. They can't go down this road, that they have to do more to protect civilians. And as the Netanyahu government has kind of ignored a lot of those calls.
Yeah, it didn't work.
Right. He's becoming maybe a little bit more public in that. But as, you know, the French president did weeks ago, as others around the world did weeks ago, the United States still needs to be Israel's strongest ally. And so I get why he would have done it privately for so long. But I think there's a level of frustration that a lot of those calls went unlistened to.
Sarah?
Can I back this up into a more philosophical conversation that I think
what we're here for? Absolutely.
Get to where I am. You know, I think the point about what America has done to save lives overall, but it costs lives in the short term, was well taken, right? Dropping the nuclear bomb twice. So here's my philosophical question. Dropping the nuclear bomb cost tens of thousands of civilian lives, and it saved more lives than it cost in the long term because of what would have been the ground invasion of Japan. Okay? The civilian lives were killed indiscriminately by the nuclear bomb, and the ground invasion at least would have attempted to spare civilian lives, though again, it would have cost more civilian lives, but the intent would have been different. Were we right to drop the nuclear bomb?
Well, it's like 9/11. I mean, are U.S. fighter jets going to shoot down that commercial aircraft if they're convinced to...
To save more lives on the ground. Exactly. This is all... And like, why do we think that's morally different? But we do, because that's how our human brains are wired. So I get back to the nuclear bomb question. Mo, would you drop the nuclear bomb to save lives in the long run?
I'm so glad I was not... around to have to grapple with that question at the time, because I can only imagine how difficult of a decision that was in real time for this exact reason. But I do think there are some major differences, and I don't think we can make a clean comparison between the two. We were at war with a well-defined nation state with a government that had been going on for years and years and years. It was a world war, and the choices were this ground invasion or the dropping of the nuclear bomb. And I am with you. I believe we saved more lives by dropping the nuclear bomb. But the world then decided afterwards, we can never do that again. And that's why there have only been two nuclear weapons ever detonated in warfare in world history, because I think the world all saw that. But look at the history of conflict since then. If you look at the history of world and military conflict since then, when there have been this indiscriminate death of civilians, it may have ended one conflict, but we have seen time and time again the rise of a longer, more sustained conflict as a result. And we have seen this time and time again, increasingly, as warfare has changed and we find that the enemy combatants are not members of a well-defined nation state, right? In this era where, whether we're fighting terrorists, you know, in ISIS or Al-Qaeda or now what we're seeing with Hamas, these are not well-defined nation states. And we are seeing that it we're playing whack-a-mole. We're taking care of one problem and another rises.
I think that's the president's point. And that's what I wanted to loop back to, because I think as we look for a thread in his foreign policy and the kinds of points that I think you're both making, bringing up better than this administration can articulate what the actual policy is. I was looking back at President Biden when he was in the Senate after 9/11. I mean, he's made this claim that he was never in favor of the war in Afghanistan. And that's been fact checked because he actually voted after 9/11 to authorize military force in Afghanistan. But like just weeks after that campaign began, he went to the Council on Foreign Relations and he said, if the U.S. keeps bombing Afghanistan, they're going to look like a high-tech bully that thinks from the air we can do whatever we want to do. And he said critics of the U.S. might make a case that the U.S. is indiscriminately bombing innocents. And I mean, it's exactly what he's saying today, which just strikes me as this president is basically saying when there is a terrorist attack, there is a window, but you have to protect innocent life as best as you can. And he recognizes the risk to, you know, the image abroad. And I don't know, to me, it is very consistent with what his policy is on so many things. It's like trying to find a middle ground, trying to understand public opinion, trying constantly to be pragmatic, to do what is quote unquote reasonable. And you could knock him left and right for that. And he takes it from both sides. But that might be who he is and the kind of president you're going to have for four more years if you elect him.
A problem that I see in Western liberalism, and I don't here mean Democrat, Republican, but with Western liberalism, is they think Hamas are rational actors who have Western liberal values, like life. They don't. So what happens when you're up against a non-governmental entity that actually does not value life, does not have Western values the way that we do? Yeah, Joe Biden's looking for like a happy solution here where everyone can rationally come to the table. They're not rational, Hamas, I mean, not in the way that we think of rationality. So if they don't share our basic values for life, and they've said that they want to kill as many Jews as possible, and I know I've asked this before, what is Israel supposed to do? Because since they don't value their own lives or the civilian lives, there is no happy solution to this like Joe Biden wants, where just like, oh gosh, if everyone would just come to the table, they could realize they have more in common than their differences. Like, that's not what's going to happen here.
But
right?
I don't think he's looking for a happy solution. That's what he's good at, is realizing that. And this is the withdrawal from Afghanistan. This is some of his other policies when it comes to immigration.
He would have an idea of what Israel should actually do. He just wanted them to not fight Hamas in a way that is the only way to fight Hamas. Like, he wants Hamas not to be in the hospitals. Great. I wish they weren't either.
Is it the only way to fight Hamas? Look, I'm with you. They are not a rational actor. They are not a rational actor, and they are not a traditional nation state, which complicates how war is waged against them. We 100% agree on that. But if you look tactically and strategically at how Israel is waging this war, right? This week, there was a lot of coverage about their use of dumb bombs in this war, right? They are using less precise weaponry than they have, as opposed to using precision-guided smart bombs. They're using dumb bombs, which result in less precise targeting, which increases the likelihood of the target being off and more civilians being killed. I think that's where the president is trying to go with this conversation. We saw Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, this week sit down face-to-face with the Israeli War Council and the Prime Minister Netanyahu, bringing that specific case up, among others. Use better weaponry, use better tactics that will minimize. I don't think anybody is saying wage this war against Hamas and you better not kill any civilians. Everybody recognizes that in war, civilians tragically die. But are there things they can do to minimize that fallout, which will further complicate the end game? And that's what I hear the president saying, not don't destroy Hamas, but even just this one case, use precision-guided weaponry as opposed to the more indiscriminate type that you're using.
All right, we have to stop there. I think this is very reflective of this issue. It never is feels resolved, including our conversation about it. We'll have to leave it there for now. And we're going to come back and talk about the primary system in our presidential elections and whether there are other options out there. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from across the political spectrum. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW.
All right, we're back again with more Left, Right, and Center. I'm David Green. We have Mo Alethi here. He's executive director at Georgetown University's Institute of Politics and Public Service, and Sarah Isger, who is a lawyer. She's senior editor at The Dispatch, former spokesperson at the Department of Justice under President Trump. You know, we are all familiar, I think, with the presidential primary process. Americans all over the country gather in school gyms and libraries and churches and sports complexes and other places. And, you know, we always hear about Iowa, New Hampshire. Sorry, Mo, also South Carolina. I know Democrats are excited to move them up in the calendar. We talk about this for longer than we really want to. And the primary process seems to extend for so long with delegate counts and waiting to see who's actually going to be in a general election. But here's a question. Does it have to be that way? One person asks, what if we scrapped the primary altogether? And that person is Hans Noll. He's an associate professor of government at Georgetown. He studies political parties. He's the co-author of The Party Decides, Presidential Nominations Before and After Reform. Hans, thank you for being here. And I know you know Mo. Do you guys like carpool together to campus ever? Or what is the? How often do you see each
other? We try to party whenever we can together.
Oh, good. Good.
It would be fun.
Well, invite me next time. So Hans, tell me about what you're thinking, what you're trying to do here. You're trying to blow up the whole primary process, the way we get nominees into the general election?
Well, on a certain level, yeah, it is blowing it all up. Although on another level, this is actually, you know, the system that we have and in theory could just snap back to anyway. We already do have the decision made technically at a convention. It's just that by the time the delegates get to the convention, they've already been pledged to a particular candidate. And so there's somebody who has an outright majority and we know what the first vote's going to look like. And so there's no deliberation happening at the convention. And I think there should be. I think that it would be better if you had representatives from the party across the country, from all the different states, gathering together and discussing the possible nominees, including maybe even some people who didn't put their names in the ring, so to speak. But probably mostly people who do, and, you know, talk them through and say, you know, this is the trade-off that's involved, and not sort of be bound by the weird dynamics of the primary process. That's, I think, what the reformers kind of had in mind when we got put into place the system that eventually got us to where we are today. And I think it would have been good.
So a big change you're making is the delegates who would be coming to the convention actually have power to gather and decide on the nominee. It's not just a show to confirm what we already know.
Exactly.
What problem would that solve? Like, tell me what you see flawed in the system today and what you're trying to fix and improve here.
Sure. So it solves two problems. One is that the early states have a much larger say in the process than later states. Mid to early states then have a pretty good say as well. So early states sort of decide who gets to stick around, and they winnow the list down to a smaller group. And then middle states get to sort of say, okay, yeah, this is who we actually choose. And then by the time the states are voting. It's a sort of foregone conclusion. That is not very democratic. However representative you can make those early states be, it's still not everybody. This would be a way to address that. Would get the delegates from all the states would then, you know, show up at the convention with sort of equal, equal weight, and that would be better. But even aside from the, you know, unrepresentativeness of it, it's very hard in a voting context to bargain and negotiate and make trade-offs and so forth. It's hard to say, hey, we're a party, to take the Democrats example, we're a party that, you know, really cares about protecting the environment, but we also really care about racial equality, and we also really care about economic inequality, and we also care about these other things. We need to find a candidate who can do all of those issues and is concerned with all of them, and can compromise all of those different perspectives, and who can work well with other members of the party when it comes time to bargaining with Congress and everything else. That type of process is really hard to do if you're just having voters voting and they know maybe even quite a lot about the candidates, but probably not everything about everybody, and they don't know who's willing to work with whom or bargain or anything else. Whereas if you are at a convention and the party is collectively doing that kind of conversation, you can get that kind of negotiation. That, I think, is the bigger deal. But the prior point is also important and worth paying attention to as well.
You know, I think back to this conversation I had. I mean, it's been like a decade with a 30-something business owner in Russia. And I was having a conversation with him about this whole question of, like, you know, we assumed for years that after the Cold War, Russians, you know, would want to have American style democracy, which is such an America centric point of view that I have, you know, basically tried to get out of my brain, because not everyone in the world wants, you know, our system and so forth. But democracy is something I truly believe in. And I was saying, like, you know, we have a democratic system. You have a guy named Vladimir Putin who could be in office for 3 decades. And he was like, you think your system is really democratic? And I was like, yeah, what's wrong? He's like, the Electoral College? Like, what the hell is that? Also, you have the same names, you know, Bush, Clinton. And I realized, like, I started looking in the mirror at our own system. And that's why I'm so fascinated by what you just brought up. There's this impulse, if there are any changes to something like the primary process, to say, oh, my God, it's not going to be democratic anymore. But the way the primaries work, what does democratic even mean? I mean, when you have all this complicated schedule of states and everything, but it feels like that's an important part of the messaging around the kind of thing you're talking about. Like, what is democratic and what is not, and what does that word even mean?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, a big part of what the current system has going for it in its, you know, case for being democratic is that people are voting, right? That people vote, and then they voted, and that vote goes directly to the process of choosing the candidate. And we think that that's really good. People voting is good, and it is good. But of course, it's not everybody that's voting. And what they're voting on is just whichever candidates happen to be able to stand up a campaign in state after state after state, which is not everybody. And so, you know, there are other ways of doing, you know, that kind of representation. Most democracies select the sort of the head of government from a member of parliament by the parliament. And they, you know, the voting is, let's send a bunch of parties to parliament to have a representative group of people. And I don't, you know, presidential systems and so forth, there's advantages and disadvantages, but I think we really fixate on the voting part and to our, you know, sort of blindness.
Mo, Sarah, I want to bring you in and throw this question to just all three of you. Like, I mean, not just, is this a good idea? But more importantly, are we talking about something that's just not going to happen? Like, is there really an appetite for changing how we choose nominees in our country? Like, if this happens, is it going to be anytime soon?
Look, I mean, I think there's a few layers here worth unraveling. You know, first, and anyone who's listened to the show for any period of time have heard us talk about this a little bit. Sort of this existential question of whether the challenges we see in democracy today are because we've over-democratized it. And, you know, and that's a bit of I'm being a little bit flip in posing the question that way, because certainly I don't want to diminish the voice of voters. But the current system, which was born out of reforms in the 1970s, ended up resulted in the complete and total weakening of our political parties. And that's something Sarah and I agree on and have talked about a number of times.
Yeah.
By taking away, I mean, parties are supposed to nominate or are supposed to select their nominees. Before those reforms, Hans is right. It was done by delegates at a convention. There was a lot of horse trading and a lot of negotiations, but it would all resulted in sort of the selection of a candidate who best represented the party in that moment. What we see today is we don't even know what the parties stand for today. We just pick our nominees and shape the party around them. Look at Donald Trump. By going straight to voters, as opposed to working through a party apparatus the way we used to do it, he was able to defeat the traditional Republican Party within the construct of the primary process and reshape it. No longer was it a free trade, small spending Republican Party, pro-corporate Republican Party that we had seen, you know, for generations. Instead, it became something completely different. And by 2020, the party didn't even put forward a platform anymore. They said, we're just going to go with whatever the big guy wants. That's our platform. The party stopped standing for something once they stopped being able to select their own candidates, and they opened up the floodgates. And so I think that is a real problem. The other problem, and this gets to your other question, David, about whether or not there's appetite for reform. Sure, there's always appetite for some changes. People know I sit on the Rules and Bylaws Committee of the Democratic Party.
You moved up South Carolina, which seemed like sacrilege to a lot of people.
We blew up our calendar a little bit because we saw the inequities in which early states were having an outsized voice in winnowing the field, and we wanted to diversify that. So we will continue to see some changes and reforms pop up every now and then. Will that be enough? Will that be enough to address the legitimate concerns that Hans is raising? I don't know. All I know is every time we have tried to reform this process, we have ended up weakening the party apparatus even more. And as a result, we are becoming a much more personality-driven form of politics than we are an ideologically driven form of politics.
Sarah, you like this idea?
Yeah, there's like Chesterton's fence, G.K. Chesterton, this idea that like before you tear down the fence, maybe ask why it was built in the first place. I am someone who has come to that realization the hard way when it comes to political parties. When I first got into politics, I was that kid who I now, when I'm teaching, you know, gently roll my eyes at and explain to them how the world works, right? Like I didn't want to work in the Republican Party or the Democratic Party. They were both, somewhere between pointless and corrupt. You know, like they had ideological incompatible things that just each went into their buckets because it was like a hungry, hungry hippo game of constituencies at some point. And there's no ideological through line on either side. So you got to just pick a team. So I was like, yeah, like these parties are stupid and we should do everything we can to undermine them. And that's what the purpose of campaign finance reform was in 2002, McCain-Feingold, right? Parties up until that point had these slush funds. You could donate directly to the slush fund, and then they would use the slush fund to dole out money to their preferred candidates. Well, that sounded like terrible to me, and we should get rid of that. So we did, largely speaking. You can still donate money to political parties, but at this point, candidates don't look to political parties to help them, really. Candidates look to small dollar donors, right? Power to the people. It's everything we said we wanted. Big money out of politics, parties no longer controlling who's running under their banners, yada, yada. It's a disaster on every metric. And, we've talked about it. Mo, I think, did a pretty good job summarizing. We may disagree on the margins, but certainly not in the result. Right? I should have spent more time asking why the fence was there, what all the fence does. If you get rid of the fence, what happens? So while yes, I'm all for the sort of utopia being described, I fear that that's not what happens because most people do not have the time to invest in who is running for office. It's how we've ended up in a world where high name ID is now a better predictor of success than money, because the name ID is all people really know. That's how you get Donald Trump as president. I know that's like a cliche thing. That's how you get Donald Trump. But like, yeah. And a whole lot of other famous people who have run for office, who were famous before they ran for office. So look, I still don't love the political party system that we have. I certainly don't like the two parties. They still have all the same ideological problems, but they've gotten worse in terms of like the ideological inconsistencies in both parties. But the weakening of the parties has exacerbated the problems. So unless somehow we can just kill them off, which doesn't seem to be what's happening, as we've made the parties weaker, they've somehow partisanship, more people have become more partisan to weaker parties. So yeah, you asked about the realisticness of it. It's odd because it's not what you'd think would have happened, you know, in the Petri dish version of this experiment. But what's happening in the real world version of this experiment is pretty catastrophic.
Well, I want to talk about the real world kind of as it relates to this. We're going to take a quick break and we'll come back. Hans Knoll, stay with us if you don't mind.
Sure.
We'll be back in a second with more Left, Right, and Center.
Thanks for listening to Left, Right, and Center. Is there someone in your life who could benefit from hearing a civilized discussion from all sides? Share the show with them. You can stream all episodes at kcrw.com/LRC, straight from the KCRW app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Okay, we're back again with more Left, Right, and Center. We have Hans Knoll with us. He's an associate professor of government at Georgetown who studies political parties. And Hans, I want to pick up with what Sarah was talking about before we took a break. We have this democratic experiment, which we like to say. I mean, Sarah, you used the term Petri dish and talked about what we would be doing with our democracy if it were in a Petri dish versus the real world. Like, and I'm now thinking about this presidential election in kind of a different framing. It's like we have two likely candidates who a lot of voters say they don't want. They would rather have different names out there. That's true. We have the reality that a lot of the country does say they love Donald Trump and want him to be president. That's true. And we're talking about this real deep question of, in order to save our democracy and avoid, for example, having a president return who has a lot of, I will say, authoritarian tendencies, would it be better to give political parties more power again, even if it means taking some of the direct power out of the hands of voters? I know I'm not resolving anything, but it's just such an interesting sort of moment in our country's journey. And it feels like it is so front and center right now with these two candidates likely facing off in the next year.
Yeah, I think one of the things that, you know, Mo said earlier about, you know, there's sort of this debate about how over-democratized the system may have gotten, and that's the framing that we have here. And it's not wrong, but I think in a real way, I mean, a system that centers parties and lets parties make decisions about who the nominees are is not sort of inherently less democratic than a system that says, well, Donald Trump has a lot of influence, and so he's going to be the nominee, and there's nothing anyone can do about it. And Joe Biden is the incumbent, and he's going to be the nominee, and there's nothing anyone can do about it. That doesn't strike me as particularly more democratic either. So it's not really so much about over more or less democratization, but rather recognizing the role that political parties should play in making democracy thrive. When I was growing up, I was like Sarah was. I thought that parties were the problem, and we needed to find some way to break through them and go around it. And then, you know, I went to grad school, and I, you know, spent most of it learning about why the fence was there. And the parties, they make sense. They do a role. They play a role. I mean, I think we mostly just look at them as they play a role that they don't, because anybody who wants to win office is going to create a party and do all these things. But they also play an important role in democracy, in that they are the way in which people aggregate their preferences. They're the way in which people understand the differences between candidates. They're the way in which politicians organize and compete. And politics is essentially it's a team sport. You ally with other people. And if you want there to be a democratic link between what's happening in government and voters, then that link has to be around the teams that people are forming to do stuff. and those teams are the parties.
Would Donald Trump and Joe Biden be the nominees next year if we had a system more like the one you're talking about? If we just elect the delegates and they made the decision?
I think it's hard to say, right? What would happen? I think, you know, both of those candidates have a lot of influence in the party in general, right? And there's a lot of people who would be delegates at a Republican convention who like Trump, and there's a lot of people who would be delegates at a Democratic convention who like Biden. I think, you know, but we might not have gotten to this point in the first place.
If you go back in the time machine in 2016, Donald Trump hijacked the Republican Party. There was no way that Republican Party leaders would have nominated Donald Trump in the first place. So, like, but then you can go back as far as you want and end up with different whatevers.
So would he have not been able to emerge in the same way? Like if we had a different system,
if we did not have primaries, Donald Trump would have never gotten, you know, cracked through the egg.
And do we think that's, and we think that would be a better version of our democracy?
I will leave to others whether it would be better.
Here's what I would say. I think so because the problem that the Republican Party was facing in 2016 was that there was, you know, there were a lot of divisions within it. Even independent of Donald Trump, there was a more Tea Party oriented direction. There was a more established party. There were a lot of these directions. And what the party should have done or would have liked to have done, I think, is to say, okay, let's find a candidate who can bridge all of this. And I don't know who that candidate could be. It wasn't Donald Trump. It probably wasn't Ted Cruz. And it probably wasn't Jeb Bush. But there could have been a candidate who tried to bridge all of that and brought the party together and said, this is what we're going to try to say and what we're going to do. But a system where you have to win in primary and caucus and primary and caucus doesn't let that happen. And so it didn't.
All right. Hans Knoll is an associate professor of government at Georgetown University who studies political parties. And we really appreciate you coming on and talking about this and envisioning maybe a different system that perhaps maybe one day we'll see, Hans. Or not.
Maybe one day.
That's right. Have a wonderful holiday. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I want to turn now to a question that is coming out of the state of Arizona. If lawmakers pass a law and that law is challenged in court and the lawmakers speak up to try and defend the law, do they have to explain under oath why they supported this law in the first place, what their motive was? So this is a really interesting question coming from Arizona, and Arizona is where we're going to focus today as part of our 50 states series. This is our way of, you know, zooming in from one state to the next to see politics from the ground up and see what stories we might be missing on the ground and what we can glean from them. So this issue in Arizona, there are these state laws that were enacted in 2022 that require proof of citizenship to vote in a federal election. Critics said this law clearly discriminates and violates equal protection rights. Supporters say this law just ensures a fair election and it really only impacts a small number of people.
Arizonans will not have to re-register to vote. It will be business as usual for 99.9% of Arizona voters. This only affects a very small percentage of total voters. And even then, we actually grandfathered in all of those individuals who already are registered to vote that have some form of proof of citizenship on file.
For naturalized citizens, I think it puts a little bit of a target on naturalized citizens because it says that our election officials, if you say you're a U.S. citizen and have been recently naturalized, it puts a duty on the election officials to check some really outdated databases and then use that to determine whether or not they should start a criminal investigation against you.
All right, so that was Arizona State Senator Jake Hoffman, who sponsored the bill during his time as a state representative, and then Alex Gulata, who's the Arizona State Director for the voting rights group. All voting is local. So what was the true reason for these laws? Are they discriminatory, or were they just to help make sure that an election was fair? So usually lawmakers don't have to answer that question. They're protected by legislative privilege. They don't have to explain themselves. But in this case, State Senate President Warren Peterson and Speaker of the House Ben Toma sought to defend the laws in court. And according to the Biden administration and the Democratic Party, that was the trigger to force them to fess up to the true intentions of the law. The argument being that if these guys are going to interject and say this is not discriminatory, well, then their motive is in question legally. So what was their motive? This is kind of fascinating stuff to me. It's made its way to the U.S. Supreme Court. The justices, with no comment, refused to bail out these lawmakers, in effect, meaning that they have to answer in depositions what the motives were of this law. I love this because I think in some grandiose, fantasized world of our political system, everyone who makes laws and is in office would have to take truth serum and actually tell you what their true intentions were, whether it was just to win an election, whether it was because they are discriminating against a certain group. But I understand why that is not going to happen. But it was interesting. The Supreme Court said these guys have to talk about what the true intentions of this law were. Sarah, you're a lawyer. What do you make of this?
I was so confused about why you wanted to talk about this.
But now you get it.
I think I do. But let me tell you why I was confused, why you wanted to talk about it also, which is it got into some really nitty gritty legal stuff on what exactly was at issue in this case. So you talked about the legislative privilege. And I think it's really easy for people listening to the podcast to be like, chuck the legislative privilege. Like, why do we need that?
Yeah, everyone should say why they're passing laws.
Yeah, but like, we actually want the legislative privilege. It's sort of baked into the system the same way that like judicial immunity is and things like that. And that you don't want people to use the system to intimidate or bully the minority, so to speak. So if you can just haul legislators out and make them testify about everything they're doing or be liable for criminal prosecution, things like that, you're really not going to have a very functioning legislative system. So here, by the way, in the end, the result is not that, by not wading into this on an emergency application to the Supreme Court, what the Democrats were arguing was that basically you don't need to decide now, Supreme Court. You don't need to give them a blanket waiver from testifying because all we want to ask them about is legislative intent. What was the legislature's purpose? Not what their purpose was. So in their briefing, they were like, we're not going to ask them about their personal motivations at all. And the legislators were like, yes, they are. And that was just like a factual dispute that wasn't going to get resolved. So by staying out of it, the Democrats were saying, they can, if we ask questions that they go to their personal intent, the legislature's intent, they can just decline to answer and then appeal that sanctions or contempt order, et cetera. But we're not going to ask those questions. So like, you don't need to wade into this. And I think that's really why the Supreme Court didn't, right? They don't like doing stuff on an emergency basis. There's a reason there were no noted dissents. I promise you there's disagreement at the Supreme Court over the scope and breadth of legislative privilege.
See, this is making me sad because in my dream world, this is the court basically saying, and I know this is not the case, but to me, what's important here is like, if I think this law was supported by a lot of lawmakers because they're like, and I'm sorry, a lot of our constituents are discriminate against immigrants. And the true intent is to whip up support from them and stay in office. And so that's why they passed this law. And to have to actually cop to that would make me really happy. And I think that's the case in a lot of laws and policies we see in government and politics. Like if we actually could hold people we elect accountable for what their intentions are, things would be different. But Mo.
Well, let me just broaden this for one second, because the Supreme Court is also going to have this very interesting moment about these immunity arguments, because that's what's coming up to the Supreme Court on President Trump and presidential immunity. So the Supreme Court justices are about to have a whole lot of schooling, if you will, on the scope of official act immunity.
Mo, take us home.
Looking at this Arizona case specifically, I mean, I'm with you, David. I want, in an ideal world, if you want to vote for something, you should be able to tell your voters why. And elections are there to help, you know, for voters then to be able to weigh in on whether or not they like your answer. If you don't want to tell them, you don't have to tell them, and voters can decide if they care about that. But this was interesting, right? Because this ruling wouldn't have come down if these legislative leaders hadn't weighed into the legal case that was already out there. There was a lawsuit filed to strike down this law. And
arguing that it discriminated against immigrants.
Right. And so these two legislative leaders stepped up and said we inserted themselves to fully defend it, but in fully defending it, refused to give a defense.
Right.
Refused to explain why. And that's when the court said, all right, you know what? Like, you're now you're being too cute. They weren't saying you had to tell us when you voted for it, where you were on it. They were saying once you weighed into this legal matter, once you weighed into this legal question, that was on you. That's your choice. So tell us. Tell us why. And they're like, oh, wait, we didn't realize we would be asked to actually defend it. And that's where I think they were being too cute by half. Yes, I'm with you. In an ideal world, legislators should have to explain to people why they support something. Voters then decide. But if you're going to weigh in on a legal matter, you kind of should have that obligation.
Well, and this is, and I'll finish with this, like one more example. I hope that our judiciary might save our democracy at a time when our democracy seems to be falling apart. Because sometimes, I mean, when lawmakers want to just jump into the legal system and say like, no, this law isn't violating equal protection. It's not discriminating against immigrants. It's like, you know, a court is going to find ways to hold them accountable when it's the right thing to do based on our laws. And I will stop there because we are out of time. And we'll leave it at that. And we have reached that time for our Left, Right, and Center rants and raves. I don't remember who's gone first recently, so it's Sarah's turn. Sarah.
I've got a rave because it is the Christmas season. I love getting Christmas cards, and thank you to everyone who puts in the effort back in August to take some picture of your family, to pull together all of the addresses of everyone you've ever known and send out these Christmas cards. They bring joy on several levels. One, of course, I love seeing the updates about you and your family and how big your kids have gotten and the adorable new puppy, etc. But also, I will tell you, this year, our 3.5-year-old, somehow he said it was in a dream that he saw that you could put Christmas cards on refrigerators. But our refrigerator isn't made of metal, I guess. And so there's no magnetizing that. And so I was like, but he was really sad about that. And I was like, well, what if we just use tape? And he was like, great idea. So I would give him pieces of tape. He would put it on the Christmas card. And they're all around our house, including one hanging from the ceiling. They're going up the staircases. They're ones next to an air vent. It's actually delightful. So A, love all of you who send Christmas cards. And B, to those receiving Christmas cards, get more creative with where your Christmas cards go. They can decorate your whole house and bring you joy when you open a door and you didn't know that your friends would be staring at you while you pee.
I hope mine is near the air vent. Although I haven't sent you one, so I don't get to ask for that. But next year. Mo.
I have neither a rant nor a rave. Great. I have a mystery.
Oh.
Last week, there was quite a bit of press attention around a letter that was circulated, unsigned, by anonymous White House interns, expressing their disapproval of the president's policy on Israel and Gaza, urging him to call for an immediate ceasefire. Got a lot of attention. About 40 White House interns signed onto it, though anonymously. But as people were looking into it, they realized they didn't know how this all got started. It got started on a White House intern GroupMe chat, which is not an official platform in the White House. It's not run by the White House. It's just an informal group chat with a bunch of interns. And it got started when a woman by the name of, or someone by the name of Thara Nagarajan entered the group chat with a link to a letter urging people to sign it within the next 24 hours and then hopped off the chat. Problem is, nobody knows who this person is. It's not another White House intern. Has no social media presence. No one could figure out where this person came from. And it started raising all sorts of questions about how this effort began, whether it was legitimate. Now, that's not to undermine the fact that 40 White House interns signed the letter and expressed a legitimate concern to the White House. But the fact that someone who no one knew and may or may not actually exist was able to infiltrate this group chat, circulate this and get it done has raised all sorts of questions. The White House interns are leaving campus in a matter of weeks. They will be done with their internship. And when they leave, they may never know how this whole effort got started.
That's amazing. Okay, I'm going to rave about The Daily Show. I want to say, when it comes to political satire, I am equal opportunity. I don't care about party, who the candidates are, whether I like them or not. That's the big thing I want to say. But The Daily Show has given us one of the best pieces of political satire this election season. You know, Ron DeSantis looks kind of lost in thought on debate nights. Well, The Daily Show took some moments caught on camera of DeSantis, you know, trying not to look awkward. And they let us in on his inner monologue.
Remember, Ron, you are normal. You are not weird. You are 5'11". Your suit is soft and your shoes are grown up big boy shoes. That's it. Pretend you're listening to music, human music. Good. Check the phone. Normal style. Activate conversation mode. Hello, you're busy. Okay, love you. Bye. Come on, Ron, be normal.
All right. Thank you for that, Ron DeSantis' inner monologue. And with that, we're going to say goodbye. Sarah Isger, Moa Lathy, Hans Knoll, appreciate you all. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Mark K. Green. Our executive producer is Arnie Seipel. The show is recorded and mixed by Desmond Taylor. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. Left, Right, and Center is a co-production of KCRW and Fearless Media, and we are distributed by PRX. I'm David Green. Come back for more Left, Right, and Center next week.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.